Welcome to the Materials Universe podcast, where we will explore the materials world and how it shapes our lives. My name is Bailey Tibbett, and I will be your host this season. Please join me as I interview researchers from the Center for Dynamics and Control of Materials at the University of Texas at Austin. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Materials Universe podcast. I'm your host, Bailey Tibbett, and I'm here with our co-host,
Audrey Colgrove. Hi, everyone.
Today, we have Dr. Mark Wisteet, who is a professor of physics at the Material Science, Engineering, and Commercialization Program at Texas State University. He is an author and co-author of 2 book chapters, more than 88 articles, and 1 patent. So, welcome, Dr. Wisteet.
Thank you.
Would you mind starting by explaining your research to us?
Sure. Before I do, I want to say what I always try to say in public events, which is thank you, taxpayers, because you make my world possible, and I try to make your world better. What I do in my research is I work in photonics. I try, in my work, we make things like lasers and solar cells. So we turn electrons into photons, which is light, and we turn light back into electrons, which is electricity. The way we do that is we make new materials that are able of producing light efficiently, more efficiently than others have been, or in places that light has not been possible to make, like, for example, on top of existing electronic computer chips. So computer chips are made of a material called silicon, and it turns out silicon has a property that prevents it from ever emitting light. And that's really unfortunate because there are a lot of things we could really do way better, including training AI language learning models with much less energy and effort if we could use light for our computation instead of electricity. So we're working on making new materials that we can grow directly on top of the computer chips so that they can talk to each other using light instead of electricity, mostly because it's faster, but it would also be more energy efficient.
Interesting. Would you mind expanding on, I guess, why silicon can't make light?
It has a property called an indirect band gap, which is a fancy way of saying that when you take an electron from its lowest energy state, where it's happy and calm and quiet, sitting in its beanbag chair, having a cup of iced tea, and you excite it to a higher energy state, and then you let it fall back down to where it was, instead of emitting that excess energy as light, which a lot of other materials would do, it just emits it as heat instead. So instead of getting a nice big bang of light out of it falling back down to the bottom, it just emits heat instead.
Interesting. Okay. So is there like an ultimate goal for your research?
Make life better for everyone.
Yeah.
We try to work on we solve problems in fundamental science in materials because we have a goal of a thing that we want to make. We want to make a better, more efficient solar cell, or we want to make a more efficient laser, or a laser that could work in tandem with electronics. I really get a lot of joy out of having something at the end of the day that I can hold, and I can say, hey, check this out, this thing works, and you could use it too. That gives me a lot of happiness. It's one of the reasons I became a professor, so that I could do research and try to find new ways of making things, especially things that would be useful for people.
That's one of my favorite conversations that we kind of get to have in these spaces, is conversations with makers. Hmm. Is there, maybe we'll have to come back to this, but are there any other parts of your life where you get to be a maker?
Well, as it turns out, yes. I do a lot of tinkering. My garage is full of projects, some of which are half finished, some are just beginning, and some are in preparation. I do like to make and tinker, put together new combinations of things. I was a huge Lego nerd all growing up. I still have all my old Legos. And still pull them out sometimes if I need to do a quick prototype or demo or something, because it's just a really easy way to make something to test.
Yeah. Well, that's really cool. I mean, I think we all know, like, Legos aren't technically made out of photons only. So I wanted to ask, what drew you to photonics as a field?
Yeah, I got here from a recommendation from one of my favorite teachers in undergraduate, John Carlston, back at Montana State University in the physics department. And he was just starting to get into photonics. And it turned out Bozeman was at the cutting edge of what would turn into a very large expansion in photonics. ILX Lightwave, Big Sky Lasers, there were a half a dozen companies that were founded about the same time, and then another dozen or two started soon after that. So there was a lot of activity going on in Bozeman at the time, and he thought it would be something I'd be interested in, and he was sure right. I love photonics. I love the playful feel of light, being able to move it around a table in my lab, get it to focus down to do something interesting on a piece of silicon or other materials, and at the same time it's very responsive to analysis. You can solve for the equations. It will say exactly how much power I'm going to get at this point at this time. If I want to know where focus is, if I want to know how many atoms I will be able to see per photon coming in, you can calculate all that. So I like that it's both quantitative and qualitative. You get a feel for it, but you can also solve the math. And that speaks, both of those speak to me really well.
I also really love research like that. And I find it interesting because not only is your research kind of in this intersection, but like your work at large is kind of in this intersection of like physics and like electrical engineering and material science. How do you balance working in spaces that cross into different fields and stuff like that?
I love it because I love being able to ask people questions that I didn't even realize that I had. So finding people who are in adjacent fields to say, hey, if you had, like I was sitting next to an Air Force major on a plane once, and I said, you know, what if you had somebody who could solve an optical or electronic problem for you, what would it be? And he immediately had an answer, and it turned out to be a very critical life-saving answer for a problem that we still don't have a good answer for, but it's been in the back of my head ever since then. So I love being in spaces where people who are not exactly in my field but close to it, we can start having conversations about, okay, how can we help each other? What questions do you have, and what problems are you facing that maybe something that I know or somebody that I know could help solve that, and vice versa. You know, I've got some questions about biophotonics and getting light through tissue. You know, how do I get this to work? So having people in related fields is really helpful in stirring new ideas.
I was going to ask, but could you say that, or would you say that some of your favorite parts of research is like resource connecting?
Well, I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, but we do learn how to do a lot of scavenging. So a lot of times when we're in the lab, we have some problem that's immediate. We got to get this working. We can't, you know, everything that's going on, all of our experiments are at a dead end because something broke and we got to fix it in some new or creative way because we can't get the part or it's out of stock. So finding new ways to solve a problem is always another opportunity for fun, creative output.
You were talking about working with other collaborators, though. Is there a specific way you foster like collaborative spirit within your lab?
Yeah, there's a lot of good work out there on things like, if you do a Google search for crew resource management, how they tackle problems in airplanes. That turns out to be a great way to manage manage a group as well. So there are a lot of things like tools that you can use to help bring in the people who are feeling marginalized or out on the sidelines, or like, I don't know enough, or I don't want this to be a dumb question. Like when it comes time to ask a question, ask the least experienced person in the room first for their opinion, because then they understand, yeah, they're part of the group too, and that their contribution is worth hearing.
Interesting. And now that I think about it, I do listen to flight attendants like they are the law. So it does make sense that to some extent, the planes seem to know how to run teams very well.
Yeah. So it used to be in the olden days that the captain of the plane was God. You never questioned what they did. They had all the authority, and the co-pilot was basically only an accessory to the pilot. And the pilot made all of made all of the decisions. What they found was that occasionally the captain, being human, would make decisions that would get people killed. And so they worked really hard over decades to try to even out the playing field so that everybody in the cockpit, mm-hmm. now it's usually just two people, but sometimes three or four, depending on who's in the jump seat, everybody has a say, and they actually have a structure for how you get attention, like captain, so you know that you've got somebody's attention. I think we might be, mm-hmm. and you say what you think the problem might be, and then you offer a solution, and so that and the person who's in charge, their job is to sit and listen
yeah.
rather than immediately respond. They're supposed to listen until they have heard through all of the five or six or seven steps, depending on which version of CRM you've got.
Interesting.
So reduce the hierarchy
yeah.
so that everybody's on the same level. In my group, I have my students call me coach because they're the team. They're the ones who are getting things done, and I'm just there to help make things go smoothly.
Yeah.
It would be a shame if they looked up to me as the sole decision maker mm-hmm. because that would mean that they wouldn't have or develop their ability to make their own decisions, which you need to develop for your career.
Well, and I love that because psychologically, the person who's saying coach to you probably makes different associations in their mind than if they were coming to you and saying, like, professor, because there's more of a inherent mentorship, I think, associated with coaching, maybe as opposed to, like, being a professorship.
Right.
I guess if I can mm-hmm. ask a question.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I was just curious, like, what drew you to that sort of management style? I don't think I've ever heard anyone refer to how, like, airplane crews are conducted in any means. So this is really interesting.
Yeah. I think a large part of it is from exposure to the opposite and getting firsthand views of several instances where things were just going catastrophically wrong because somebody wouldn't give up the reins to power to let the people around them correct them and say, this is turning into a Greek tragedy, or the person who's in charge is making a decision they won't let go of. You know, could you please listen? And they won't. And so I've been trying to, over the course of my life, try to think about what's the opposite of this look like? What in what fields do they encourage the collaboration aspect of things? And it turns out that collaboration, I feel, is a critical part of research. Mm-hmm. There are schools where they will hire two faculty members on the same topic and tell them from the beginning, we're only giving one of you tenure. And so that destroys any hope of collaboration. And, you know, maybe MIT can get away with that, but most of us can't. That just destroys any hope of teamwork. And you get more things done as a team than you do cutthroat.
Well, and you bear more fruit from, like, positive motivation than you do negative.
Yes.
Is what I've learned from my years teaching preschoolers. And so I'm sure the same applies to graduate students and faculty. No.
Yeah, we always try to emphasize on the podcast that the C in MRSEC is for collaboration. So now we can add to that. Not competition.
Not competition. We have to extend Bailey's famous quote now.
Yeah.
The C in MRSEC is for collaboration is Bailey's famous quote.
It's Audrey's famous quote of mine.
It gets brought up very frequently because it's so true. And, like honestly, all of the, like, a lot of the successes we see come out of, like, our MRSEC labs come out of collaborative spirit.
Yes.
Do you have any, like, anecdotes from your lab or, like, your experiences like that?
Oh, totally. I mean, even in graduate school, my advisor had students under him who were from applied physics and physics and material science and electrical engineering, and for a while, even a biologist. So we had, there were open doors across many fields, which is fantastic because no matter what research problem you just ran into, somebody would walk in and have the answer to it. Like, oh, you just need to put a better noise filter on that thing. Really? Show me. Yeah. And the answer is there.
Yeah.
So having cross collaborations is always great, not just for the building of research ideas, which it is, but also for the solving of day-to-day problems.
I really do. I, like, the more we talk about the collaborative spirit in general, I start to see it in my life in a, like, a big way, and it's really impactful. Because, like, this was just reminding me of my husband programs for 3D models, and he was really struggling with some kind of fabric dynamics. And he came to me, and he was like, what do you know about calculus? And I was like, I have a physics degree. And so we sat down, and we did calculus together, and we were kind of working through a problem from, like, my kind of physics perspective. Because, to be fair, what he was working on was kind of physics. And it was a blast because, it creates moments for, like, deeper connection and, like, spirit, I guess, energy.
I was going to joke if you having a physics degree meant that calculus was your area or meant that it was not.
When I did start my physics degree, they said I would by the end of it, I'd be one class away from a math minor. Oh. I didn't go for that. I went for the communication minor, which is how I ended up here. but yeah, no, there's a lot of math and physics. I'm sure you know that.
Yeah, but I ended up with a physics minor automatically. Yep.
They love to tack them on. I wanted to really quickly go back to some of your research because I had the privilege of listening to your talk this morning, and you said some phrases that I'd never heard before. You talked about nano marshmallows and nano geodes, and I'm just so curious if you wouldn't mind expanding on those for me, because I was in the moment fascinated because it seemed kind of like a byproduct of your work almost.
Oh, absolutely. It's a byproduct, a completely unwanted but beautiful and happy accident. In our work, we try to grow films that are atomically flat, perfectly flat and a countable number of atoms thick. So we do what's called the original nanotechnology. We can literally put down five layers of atoms if you want five, or I can put down four and then stop. So we like things that are nice and smooth and flat and go down perfectly, like a bathtub filling with water. And then every once in a while, one of these growths will just go completely wonky. And a set of our growths came out looking like they were a plate covered in gray marshmallows. So it completely did not go down flat. It came out with a whole bunch of little peas or spheres or BBs or something filling the plate. It's not what we wanted, but on the other hand, since it did go this far in the crazy direction, that opens up questions about, like, why did it do that? Because if we can understand why it did that, then we can grow better materials that are even more flat or over a wider range of temperatures or chemical conditions. So understanding that sometimes having these accidents where things go wrong helps you better understand how to make things even better than you knew you could get.
Yeah.
Had they not gone that way. The nanogeodes are we got voids in our material. It's literally a void. There's nothing inside. It's vacuum inside. But the inside of the hole is lined with a shell of tin. So we did not expect that at all. We did transmission electron microscopy and found that, yes, in fact, there is nothing in the hole. And around the outside of the hole is tin, which is not what we were expecting, not what we wanted, but it's pretty kind of cool to see and understand. Again, well, now that we know that this is a possible failure mechanism, and once we understand how it happens, we will be better able to grow even better material on the other side.
So it's really a lesson in investigating your failures.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Because I think we've talked about failure a bit before as well.
Yeah, I think it's kind of the curiosity which drives science. Like, for me, it's always been kind of hard. If something goes wrong, I want to figure out exactly why before I move on. So sometimes I need people to, like, direct me to be like, okay, well, we think this is important, but you should probably finish this line of investigation first. But I definitely, like, I really like that moment in science where curiosity is fulfilled, right? And you kind of learn a little bit that you weren't expecting, but maybe you leverage it in a positive way instead of a negative way.
Yeah.
I think that's really cool.
Yeah, totally. They used to say that science was defined like Archimedes running through the streets naked after figuring out how buoyancy worked in the bathtub. He was so excited that he just ran down the street shouting, "Eureka, I found it." And these days we do less Eureka shouting and less running naked through the streets. But what we say instead is, "That's weird." Whenever you hear that phrase in the lab, you should lean in and say, "Hey, what's weird? Because there's something new to be learned there. Like, what failure just happened? Like, what's something new just happened?" And those are the exciting moments.
In defense of Archimedes, I will say, in the modern era, I think I have seen people go on social media and just fully blast out something new they learned. And I really appreciate that because then I get to learn something new. So I would love Archimedes running naked down the street more often for me because it means I'm learning something cool.
Yeah, I do have a friend who, like, works with molecular beam epitaxy mostly. So if one of her growths goes wrong, she'll show me a picture and just be like, "See, Bailey, it's really wonky." And I'd be like, "Yeah, I totally see it." So yep. I think it's, you know, it's still there.
Yeah. Well, that's part of the spirit of science kind of as well, like being able to engage with other people, even if you don't really understand what they're talking about, which is also kind of the spirit of this podcast a little bit as well. Trying to talk about material science, even though neither of us are experts in the entire field. You had a quote that I was thinking about from your seminar earlier today. Vacancies are the enemies of devices. Would you mind expanding on that a little bit more?
Yeah. So in the kinds of devices that we're trying to make, the most common electronic device in the world by far is transistors. There are more transistors sold every year than there are stars in the universe, which is a scary thought.
Oh.
Yes, more than the number of ants on the planet.
Yeah.
More by 8 orders of magnitude. But transistors themselves, the common transistors that we usually sell in quantities of trillions, are not really susceptible to the same kinds of defects in the material that the other kinds of devices are, like lasers or solar cells. If you have, so all of our common electronics are made out of a perfectly crystalline material, so perfect crystals of silicon or perfect crystals of gallium arsenide. And a crystal just means it's repeating. There's nothing magical about it, just means we've got, it does the same thing again and again and again and again and again from one side of the piece to the other. But if one of those atoms somewhere along the line is missing, or if one of those atoms gets replaced by a contaminant like an oxygen atom or gold or iron or something that's not supposed to be there, then that can really have bad effects on the device. Like the laser might not be a laser anymore, or the solar cell might not be very efficient anymore. So vacancies are where an atom is missing from the crystal. It's a perfectly repeating structure, except where there's an atom missing. And if we're growing our material, I grow by molecular beam epitaxy also, and if we're growing our material by epitaxy and some of the atoms don't land in the right place, then we have a vacancy or a void. It's a hole in the crystal, the size of an atom usually, and that ends up being a problem because that interferes with the electrons that are trying to move through the device.
I see. I'm still a little stuck on the amount of transistors there are in the world, though.
It's unimaginable.
That really is. And like the amount I've probably come across in like physics classes and things like that, that I did not probably treat with the respect they deserve for being the superior technology.
There's more transistors sold every year than there are atoms in the chip.
Oh my God.
Okay. I think transistors themselves are like fairly basic, but you need so many of them.
Yeah. But like they're going to take over the world is what I'm hearing. They're going to become the master race of chips, I guess.
I guess, so could you call them like atomic potholes, basically?
Yeah, basically.
Yep. Oh.
It's a missing piece of material, just like a missing piece of asphalt in a road. That's a good analogy.
And when you get on the atomic level, the physics start changing a little, and you kind of start seeing movement of mass similar to how we kind of look at things on like an astronomic scale. So like with that singular atom that's missing impacts the position, I guess, of everything else around it, which can cause a lot of like negative repercussions.
Yeah, you could think of it as imagine more like maybe a golf hole. If there's a pothole in the golf course and your golf ball is not flying through the air, but it's rolling on the ground, if there's a hole there, it might just get stuck in the hole and not come out. So that's sort of what the vacancies can do. They can trap the electron instead of allowing the electron to just go on by. So we spend a lot of time trying to think about where the sources are of any possible defects in the materials that we grow.
How do you go about that process?
There's several techniques that we use. One of them is called atomic force microscopy, which is basically the same as dragging your finger across the surface to feel if it's rough, except your finger is the size of an atom. So you're just dragging this little tiny feeler back and forth across the surface to feel if you got smooth or rough. Another technique that we use is photoluminescence, where we shine light at the material and we see what light it emits. Mm-hmm. If it freely emits light, we know it's good material. If it just soaks up the light without giving anything back, it's not just being greedy, it's mm-hmm. actually bad. So there's something wrong with it and we need to figure out what went wrong so we can grow a better material the next day.
Awesome. I'm really taken by the kind of visuals that you're giving us along with these. Like it really helps make like the image for me when you're like, it's like a tiny microscopic finger. Do you that method of communication, do you use that a lot in your, like, communicating with, like, collaborators in your lab or in your, like, teaching?
Yeah, I try very hard. It's been, there was an event back in fourth grade where something was happening. The teacher was doing some kind of science demonstration on a desk, and something slipped, a hose was blowing smoke into the bubbles or something. And I was trying to explain to the teacher that something was going wrong and she couldn't understand what I was saying. And another student in the class, who wasn't even a very good student in terms of grades, he was a perfectly good human being, you know, smart and so on, but he wasn't getting good grades. He just said a few words and the teacher instantly got what I had been failing to communicate. And like, ever since that moment, I've been thinking about, oh, it's not just about knowing the right answer. It's how can you communicate to the person that you need to say this thing to? So it's been something I've been thinking about, how do I communicate some idea that I have or some issue that I need to raise, or, you know, Captain, I think we're off course. Yeah. Something like that.
Wow. All the way back in fourth grade, you realized that. That's insane, because I'm still trying to get some of my undergraduates to realize that. They're doing their best. They're trying really hard. But that's a tall concept. Like, not everyone realizes how hard it can be to communicate in a way that's accessible to multiple people and not just your own brain.
Right.
And that's obviously very important for your work and research.
Yes. And teaching, because when you're teaching classes, everybody hears things a different way. You may say the same sentence and different people will hear a different message. So you need to be able to find out where each person is coming from, what their background is, and tie what you're trying to teach in with what they already know, not what you already know, because that doesn't help anybody. So trying to understand what it is that the student who's in front of you already can understand and wants to learn, and how you can tie it in.
That reminds me of, like, this segment. So I like watching Hell's Kitchen. And sometimes he'll do this challenge where the teams, they have to cook, like, you know, four dishes or whatever, but they have to rotate.
Oh, interesting.
So the other team members have to dictate to the person who's actually cooking, like, oh, this is where this is left off. This is what I'm doing next. This is what needs to be done next. And it kind of just crashes so fast.
It's a communication challenge.
Yeah.
Can you imagine doing that in the lab?
I mean, that's what undergrads are like, but respectfully.
If you didn't write it down, it never happened.
Yes. So every episode, we like to wrap up with the same question. And it's basically, like, what emerging trends or technologies or materials do you think will have, you know, like, the biggest impact on material science in the upcoming future?
Yeah, that's a great question. Obviously, AI is having already a huge impact on the way that people think about what research is. And that's not going to go away. That's going to become even bigger. We're never going to be able to get away from having people who actually are experts in the field, because the AI doesn't really learn. It can put together papers from things that people already know, but generating new ideas, somebody's still got to be around to write the original Wikipedia article. So I think what's going to change is the sort of daily drudgery of research is going to become way easier. There's not going to be standing around and manually writing numbers in a notebook when we can just ask the AI, hey, could you watch the temperature of the hot plate for the next hour and tell me if it drifts? So I think a lot of the sort of daily tasks in science and research are going to get it a lot easier. But I think there's also going to be a lot of overturning and job losses, I'll be frank, from AI doing things that previously required somebody watching that hot plate for an hour. So I think there's going to be a painful series of transitions, a lot like the Industrial Revolution was. Glass blowers by the thousands were put out of work by a single invention by Corning. So I think that's where we are. It's just going to affect a lot more people at the same time.
I'm thinking about all those horses that lost jobs when Ford built the first car.
Yeah. Now we can say, thanks, Sam Altman.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast. It's been really lovely.
My pleasure. Thank you for taking me.
That's all for today's episode of the Materials Universe podcast. Thank you for listening to our interesting conversations with inspiring guests from different fields of science and engineering. We hope you enjoyed learning something new. Please leave us a review and share this podcast with friends. You can follow us on social media at TexasCDCM on Instagram and X. Thank you to the National Science Foundation and the University of Texas at Austin, and an additional thank you to the Late's Audio Studio crew for their help with the production of this podcast.